6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation, the big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision flyby helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am STD Noor. Today we will get an update on the situation with the proposed mine up north in the Pinoki Hills. On the phone with us up from the Lake Superior area is Mike Wiggins Jr., the chair of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us again.
Hello, ma'am. Thank you.
And am I right that you're the chair? I was doing that from memory.
Yeah, the tribal chairman from the
Tribal
River Band.
Okay. And in the studio with us is geologist Jason Huberty. And hi, Jason. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Essie. Hi, Mike.
And I just want to dedicate today's show to the memory of this great man, Nelson Mandela. And Mike, I wonder when you heard about his passing, what did you think?
Well, I was obviously moved and saddened. I think Nelson Mandela was somebody that transcended time, transcended some of the pettiness of societies and human constructs, and really had a vision that was otherworldly and was in the best interests of all people, humanity.
Yeah, Jason, anything you'd like to
just
say to
that? Inspired very much by the presence and what he could do, so it's inspiring to all of us still today.
Yeah, much. A man who, as I thought about it, truly changed the world. The world is different to a large degree because of him by the time that he passed. Anyway, Mike, the latest that I know about the proposed mine is that Gogebic Taconic GTAC submitted its stormwater application to the DNR on Monday. What does that mean, and where are we at this point? It's been about 7 months since we last talked to you.
Yeah, well, you know, we're still in the, I believe, the theatrics and shell game portion of the mining companies, you know, kind of constructs that were created to get everybody ready for when they start trying to get their permits to explode the mountainside. But, you know, we saw a lack of integrity in the exploratory drilling. That was a process and a step that was used as a PR tool. The same thing is becoming apparent here, although there's a little bit more dire and important implications that are starting to become apparent in the bulk sampling step here. First of all, what I mean by PR theatrics, public
yes,
relations
I was going to ask
theatrics, is as an example, a statement where the mining company does not want to acknowledge the presence of grunerite asbestos in the mountainside there. Yet at the same time, they stripped down their bulk sampling application to exclude all the places where grunerite asbestos has been found. Even with the relaxed mining law that they wrote themselves, they're having a hard time dealing with the fact that toxicity and harmful impacts are all over that mountainside and inside that mountainside.
So if they do not test the sites with grunerite asbestos, can they still mine there?
Well, I think why we're seeing the mining company turn and do an about-face from the geologic reality of what's present in that hillside has to do with the fact that in their mining law that the mining company wrote, there's a line in there where when they get into the permit application process later on, they have to deal with quote-unquote known adverse elements that are going to create impacts. You know, the word known is the key legal term that catches my attention and is the word that I think drives the hemming and hawing of Bob Seitz and the other folks at GTEC there, when it comes to what the reality of the geologic composition is. If they have to, by law, deal with things that are known, it's more, how would you say it? It's more convenient for them to say things like, we don't expect there to be grunerite asbestos throughout the bulk sampling sites, or to say things like, we don't expect to encounter sulfides. That those types of statements raise that little hint of doubt. Those types of statements like that keep the burden of the legal litmus of their own mining law off of them. So by hemming and hawing, they are trying to shirk their very own relaxed mining law that they wrote.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that if they don't know about something, they can go ahead and do that, and so it's convenient not to know about grunerite asbestos and about sulfites.
Exactly. It's just willful ignorance so that they don't have to have the mining law applied to them.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that this is all doing is it's all designed to acquiesce a person into and ease a person into the notion of the mining company getting into the ground. Bulk sampling serves no purpose other than for the mining company to try and get a feel for how they are going to process some of the waste rock and other items like that later on in a permitting, or later on in a mining operation. Yet at the same time, when you have asbestos, when you have sulfates, and most importantly, when you have tons of groundwater and unnamed streams and such in these areas, it's important for the mining company to be open, to be completely in touch with the reality of what's going on there. And it's also important for the DNR to essentially treat this as something that is disruptive, that is going to be impactful because of the number of wetlands and waterways there. The notion that a mining company can come in and take up to 10 million tons of rock and earth that's laying around, and they have to deal with a stormwater permit, and that's it, is a bit absurd. I know in a conversation with Larry Lynch at one of our meetings, I asked him, what happens if you start seeing, as an example, grunerite asbestos levels going up in some of the waterways and some of the air monitoring that would be around that site? His response to me was, well, obviously it would be important to have those types of regulations and safeguards in place, and then he stopped. And I knew what he was about to say, and I asked him to please continue. And he said, well, it'd be important to have those safeguards and regulations in place before, that stuff ever started. And my response to him was, and yet here we sit in the bulk sampling phase with known levels of grunerite asbestos, and that you, the DNR, picked up and tested and confirmed. We still have the mining company denying that. And here we sit with nothing but a stormwater permit to deal with. And, when all the waste rock empties into those streams and into those wetlands, much like we saw in just the exploratory drilling portion that was supposed to be minor, there's impacts, and there's no better time than right now to send a message to the mining company that even though they created a relaxed regulatory framework where there ain't much to really adhere to, the DNR is still going to approach this with integrity and do what they can to try and regulate.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that flies in the face of the Secretary of the DNR, Kathy Stepp's philosophy of the DNR is there to permit. There is an environment, there are natural resources, there is water that used to fall under the public trust doctrine in Wisconsin that is still there to be considered and there to be protected. And, you know, I know career staff in the DNR are trying to do that as best they can. It's got to go all the way up to the top, and that's the integrity that's going to be needed in this stuff. And now is the time to put that type of philosophical approach into play, into reality here in the bulk sampling phase.
Mm-hmm. And just before we go to Jason to get some more information about what is in these rocks, you mentioned some names that I want to clarify. Bob Seitz from GTAC, correct? The spokesperson, is he?
Yeah.
And Larry Lynch is from the DNR?
Larry Lynch is from the DNR, yes.
And what is his role?
Maybe Jason could give you his official title. I can't remember offhand right now.
He's in charge of the project for the DNR, managing the permitting and issuing all the different groups that are involved. He's at the top of that.
I see.
Very
okay.
Experienced and knowledgeable person.
And Jason, you are a geologist, and you actually got to see these rocks that were extracted. What did you see there?
Yeah, thanks, Esty. So just Mike has been amazing here so far, and I've really enjoyed how he's put this in perspective, because he's right. The theatrics have been very distracting from the serious and real issues that are facing people living up there, which is what will happen if they go through with this mine. It makes people who know about the rocks and the science question the seriousness, whether the company is actually serious about mining, because for 70 years these rocks have been passed over. While in Minnesota and Michigan, higher grades of iron ore have been mined that don't face the exact same situation. The rocks are flat in the neighboring states, whereas they're tilted on end in the Pinoki Range. That means to do an open pit in the Pinokis, you need shallower walls than the rocks are at a steep layer. Those shallow walls mean more of the overburden gets excavated, and the overburden rock has been shown and known for 100 years now to contain sulfide minerals, but also there are waste layers in the iron ore itself, and just even in the ore where you can find sulfide minerals, and it's in the upper ore member that they and myself and others have seen asbestos at Bulk Sampling Site 4, which is in Ashland County. So this was one of five bulk sampling sites that the company had said was representative of the types of rocks they would be extracting. And since the rocks had been broken up 50 years ago by U.S. Steel during previous mining and just left at the surface, the company said, well, they're inert. Nothing's happened to them. We don't have to do any blasting to pick up these rocks. But I kind of question whether they've ever gone and looked at their own bulk sampling sites before early October when the Grunerite was announced, because when I went up there in October and once again at the end of the month in November, it was really easy to find the asbestos in the bulk sampling site. And so for the dozens of people who've been up there just taking Lake Road down and walking up a couple miles, it's just 10 feet off the road and here's these piles of rocks. And once you know what to look for, it's pretty easy to find a sample. And so now there's been scientists at Northland College, Tom Fitz at Lawrence University in Appleton, and the original work that was done in the University of Madison on the sample the DNR collected back in May, they all show the same thing, that rock contains grunerite in the shape of asbestos, which is what the mineral shape is. It's the most hazardous type of asbestos minerals, and it's a direct cause of mesothelioma. So it's a huge concern for people working in the mine and for communities that would be exposed to those kinds of dust and particle emissions.
So why is it most dangerous, and what is that condition that you just mentioned that I can't repeat?
I'm not a medical expert, so I don't want to talk too
much
about
know?
Mesothelioma is a lung condition, a cancer that caused by the scratching, the scarring of the lung tissue from the particles of asbestos. And asbestos is a very long, slender fiber of a mineral grain. So people might think of minerals as having different shapes, like you've seen crystals with a pointy shape. Well, this is a very long, narrow crystal. They're very small. They're almost at the limit of naked eye vision, maybe less than a tenth of a millimeter in size. But the imaging can go down to much smaller scales than that and can see that those fibers are the same that have been classified by either regulatory agencies in the United States or by fellow geologists, people who study and describe the natural forms and occurrences of these mineral types. They're identical. And so in other places in the world where there have been asbestos mines, there have been serious health consequences, and those could be facing people living up north right now.
Mm-hmm. So will it affect first and foremost the actual miners?
It's really unclear, and I think the severity of the issue needs to be taken seriously, and so this requires further study. That the company has sidestepped that by saying in their revised bulk sampling plan they're going to remove it since it's a matter of media debate. Well, you know, they can say that all they want, but these aren't things that are belief systems. They're just what's in the actual rock itself. So the company is very incompetent if they think that they don't need to go and look at their own sites, or they could be willfully ignorant. Either way, it's a very dangerous situation for people up there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, how do you feel that DNR has been dealing with the fact, apparently, that there is asbestos in these rocks?
Well, that's going to remain to be seen. I think the most important part of the DNR's, I guess, approach, the most important way I can assess how reality is going to play out in terms of aligning itself with their philosophical approach is yet to come. We have a mining company that is sitting on top of Grünreich asbestos that is confirmed by PhD geologists combing the area. It's visible to the naked eye to the point where kids could find it. Since then, we have a mining company telling the DNR, we'll remove the areas where the media is debating about the presence of asbestos. Those are clear-cut, I believe, overwhelming messages to the DNR that, number one, we don't respect you. We don't respect the land. We don't respect the water. We're ignorant of the geologic composition that's there on the mountainside, and we thumb our noses at this whole process. It's a formality. Let's get into the exploding. The DNR has an opportunity here to send back a message that is based in science, that is based in geologic reality, and that's still to come. So I'm watching this as intently as anybody, and I'm still optimistic that science will prevail.
Mm-hmm.
The shell game and the talking points from GTAC that, we'll get to that. We'll get to that, and we'll explore that later. We'll study some. We'll make some science up later on as we get further into the mining. That stuff doesn't fly, and I'm still hopeful this is Wisconsin.
Yeah. Well, and so, again, Jason, as you said, is not a medical professional, but it seems to me that there's a great likelihood that the people who will be doing the mining will be the first to get hurt. And I wonder if that information, even though it's not very prevalent in the media, but I assume it is spreading up north there, has that affected the way the locals, the non-native locals or the non-Native American locals are seeing the mine? Because there definitely was a divide up north there between those who supported having the mine for the jobs and those who object to it because of all of these environmental and health concerns. Has that information made a difference in that divide?
I think it has, SD, because you've seen things like the Ashland County Board step forward and say that they need to enact their own ordinances for disturbing asbestos. And so one of the consequences of it being identified and publicized in the Pinokies was the legislature trying to pass a law immediately that would prevent towns like Ashland from enacting their own ordinances or supersede mm-hmm. previous ordinances. Another law they wanted to pass was a 600-foot buffer. That one did get passed to go around the mining sites and the mining roads to keep out people like myself and others who've gone up there and tried to document what's actually in the hills. So there was a really quick response from the
legislature.
To the county's dutiful obligation to their citizens to take that seriously, that if you're going to work in our county, you need to be serious about that. And they don't seem to be taking that seriously or professionally, GTAC, and that's just really disappointing, I think.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I agree with Jason there. you know, watching, watching, rather than watching the mining company get into the true science of what's needed in terms of studying the hydrology there in the mountainside, and in terms of studying the rocks and what could be impacting people in Iron County and Ashland County and in the tribe here. We've watched them pander and double talk in the media, double talk and formalize communications to DNR, and try to hide behind what have been incredibly, you know, poorly thought through legislative pieces from Tom Tiffany. And you know, I think the shutting down on the mountainside to public access, you know, for Jason and others is terrible. I mean, when Grunerite asbestos is visible, I'm sure there's sulfide minerals that are there and have been picked up and studied. When those types of things are visible to the naked eye, what's wrong with other objective scientists just strolling around looking at that stuff? Well, what's wrong with it is it creates an inconvenience for the mining company to have to deal with reality again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, we see, you know, out of Spain comes an indictment against Bill Williams, the mining company president, for crimes against the environment for the Cobre La Cruce mine that is, you know, producing poison for the people and that has wrecked groundwater, drinking water. You know, on July 23rd, 2013, Bill Williams was talking about an on-site processing plant that will recycle water, you know, mitigating pollution and stuff. And this is the kind of stuff that a lot of people are putting their faith in and believing in. Well, ask some of the Spaniards what they think of Bill Williams and his cronies, you know, and ask the courts that are looking at indicting, you know, Bill Williams and the others for crimes against the environment for poisoning their water, what they think about his promises. You know, they're empty, and we haven't seen anything remotely close to this company being interested in engaging with the DNR or anybody, you know, with integrity and based in science. It's all empty talk.
Mm-hmm. My guests again on the phone are Mike Wiggins Jr. He's the tribal chair of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, which is very close to the proposed mine site. And in the studio we have Jason Hubert, a geologist who has looked at some samples of the rocks that came from the area where the mine would be if it comes to be. We did get a question, I think I'll give it to you, Mike, from someone who didn't want to stay on the phone, but that person asked what impact will snow and winter weather have on mining development. Do you know?
Well, I think, you know, if the DNR just issues their little stormwater permit, I would expect the mining company to utilize the, you know, the frozen ground and what have you to try and travel. The impacts of snow and winter's arrival are very critical in my view, because the GTAC doesn't have a grasp of the hydrology, of the waterways, of their flow, of their interactions between when surface water drops into being groundwater, when groundwater bubbles up, becomes surface water. They're ignorant of that, and why do I say they're ignorant of that? Because their bulk sample application to the DNR has language in there where Tim Myers, the engineer, denies the presence of wetlands, denies the presence of streams. Mm. When ground truthing, people that have been there and studied that, our guys that have been around there, know full well that that water is present all around in those places, and winter's here, everything's frozen up, everything's covered up, so how are you going to study a wetland area that's covered by 2 feet of snow up in the Pinoki Hills now? The other factor that all of that's going to kind of impact is, of course, in the spring thaw. if you went to a logging site which is a lot different than mining, even loggers have an impact that's apparent after the snow melts and when the waters get rushing because of the thawing. As you can imagine, in these bulk sampling sites, when all of that snow starts melting off and all of the ice starts melting, there's a tremendous rush to the Tyler Forks River. There's a tremendous rush to all of the drainages that go down to Carolina Lake. The Tyler Forks and Carolina Lake empty into Lake Superior. And, of course, on their way, they go right through my tribe, the Bad River Band. And whatever toxicities, whatever Grunerite asbestos has been crushed and crumbled and kicked around and upset, all of that stuff will be more akin to being transported downstream to Lake Superior with the snow melt in the spring.
Mm-hmm. So you don't expect that the work will stop because of the snow. You're concerned that they will continue working and as you said, all of it will end up in the water and on the ground.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
Yeah. Anything you wanted to add, Jason?
Just that if there was bulk sampling to take place, it would happen during the winter when the roads are frozen over. Those roads, particularly Moore Park Road, which comes down from 77 to the bulk sampling sites 1, 2, and 5, aren't built to sustain the kind of traffic that could happen with all of the trucks that would be removing these millions of tons of rock. So if there was going to be any bulk sampling, I'd expect it to happen in the winter, which means they'd have to wait a year if they didn't get something this winter to at least go through that part of the plan. Other than that, just nobody who's been up there would say that the Pinokis are a dry area. It is very heavily forested with wetlands, and mm-hmm. that's apparent if you walk the area.
Yeah.
Hearing Jason say they'd have to wait a year reminds me of the fact that Nelson Mandela waited 27 years to change the world, huh? When he was put in prison.
Well, or to come out of prison, yes. And then some.
But if I could just follow up on the water issue, this is something from the beginning where the company has said to deal with any potential acid mine drainage that would come from the tailings or the waste rock. They would use a dry stacking technique, which just seems impossible to actually implement in a place as wet
That's
as the
wet.
Pinoki areas. Yeah. But this presents a double-edged sword because now with the asbestos and also the silica that's present in these same ore layers, those would create fine particulate dust in the air, and to immobilize them, you would want to keep the tailings wet. So the dilemma is the tailings would have to be wet for the asbestos and silica, but dry for the sulfide, and both things can't be true at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have several callers on the line, so let's get to the phones. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question of your guests. What hope is there that the federal EPA might get involved with this? Because the reason I ask is because I'm thinking of Libby, Montana, and the horrible problems they had out there with airborne asbestos. If they start crushing this stuff, it's going to become airborne. It's not going to be just the workers. It's going to be everybody mm-hmm. in that area up there. In Libby, we were talking about tremolite asbestos. Here it's a different type, but it's still asbestos. And I'm wondering just if the feds are interested in getting involved in this, thank you very much. Great program.
Yes, thank you. Mike?
Yeah, I'm hopeful that the EPA gets involved, to a great extent. In fact, the federal permitting side is probably going to have to run not synergized with the state permitting process, but parallel and autonomous on its own because of the fact that the mining law that the GTEC wrote may actually be in violation of, the Clean Water Act itself. That's still an open legal question. And I heard that put forth by Dr. Susan Hedman, who is the EPA Region 5 Director. She said that directly to Kathy Stepp of the DNR. At any rate, in that parallel autonomous permitting process, we expect the EPA to uphold its trust responsibility to the tribes. And at that same talk with Dr. Susan Hedman down in Chicago, who's the EPA Region 5 Director, it wasn't apparent in her comments whether or not the trust responsibility was truly intact there. However, on a recent trip to Washington to meet with EPA Administrator Gene McCarthy and Secretary of Interior Sally Jewell, we meaning the tribes, were heard the words that essentially carried the message that the EPA did indeed have the trust responsibility, and that the EPA would look to that as they approach some of these types of projects.
Mm-hmm.
The one area that is going to be problematic and that is scary is that the state DNR and the EPA fall short of truly assessing, regulating, and taking account of the micro fine,
The airborne.
Yeah, the airborne sedimentation that's created.
Uh-huh.
And there was recently a doctor that came up from, the Appalachian area where GTAC's owners did mountaintop removal, and fine particulates are killing people there. Cancer clusters and things like that are the norm. And what they're finding in the latest science on some of that micro fine particulates is that they travel further than people think. And as we heard Jason say about the crystal, silica earlier, they scar and they essentially act as a carcinogen that the body cannot deal with once they get into the lungs. We don't have any way of physiologically of stopping such a tiny little piece of dust, and those things are in the air, and they can travel a long way. I think in Minnesota there were air control monitors picking up fine particulate presence at quite a distance from some of their open pit mines, and I can't remember the exact document that I read on that right now, but at any rate, it's suffice it to say that when it comes to some of the fracking dust, when it comes to the fine particulate crumbled dust that comes with, taconite mining, I mean, where they process mountainsides to talcum powder to sift with magnets, that fine particulate matter is uncaptured on anyone's radar right now, and that is a problem that's killing people down in Appalachia.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to our next caller, the caller asked about the EPA, but the tribe also has some legal power. What can you do? What is within your ability to do, and what have you done, and what do you think of doing?
Well, we have treatment as a state status, which means as a sovereign nation, we have regulatory authority, just like the Wisconsin DNR does. Under that treatment of a state, treatment as a state umbrella, we have water quality standards, and we're on the cusp of having our air quality standards. Under our water quality standards and our air quality standards, not only do we have to meet, our very own regulations as a tribe, we also can reach out into waters that flow onto our homeland, and that's where we get into this intersection of the fact that the mining area and the Pinoki Hills, all of those headwaters are the genesis and birthplace of the waters that flow through the Bad River Tribe, and then ultimately our northern border is Lake Superior. All those waters flow into Lake Superior. So protecting the water quality, both surface water and groundwater for our people is critical. Protecting Lake Superior is something we also try and shoulder. So we will be looking to, every step of the way, have our input, push the DNR to regulate and think about humanity rather than corporations. We're going to push the EPA and the Army Corps and assist the EPA and the Army Corps with whatever data that we can get and science we can gather. In a way, the tribes all over the place act as the eyes and ears many times for the science portion of what eventually comes into play on some of the regulatory issues that the EPA and the Army Corps have to deal with around, you know, these sovereign nations. So, you know, we're trying to shoulder that as best we can and partner.
Yeah.
Ultimately, litigation is probably forthcoming. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but I haven't seen anything yet from the mining company that would dictate otherwise. And right now, we're mulling over our options on litigation right now, you know, very soon.
Yeah.
Because of the bulk sampling, you know, process, the way it's been playing out so far.
I see. Let's get to our next caller. And hello, caller, you on the air.
Hi. This is Mike. I used to work for the DNR. It seems like that was about 5 or 6 years ago before I retired, but, you know, they've changed so much now, and you're telling me that's all they require is a stormwater permit for this mine now? They used to have to do EI, environmental impact statements that would take, you know, several years, and but as an experience in working there, whatever is in the law, if it doesn't require them to do something, they won't do it. And if that's all they got to do is a stormwater permit, they're not going to look at anything else. They're not going to look at asbestos or anything.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Jason?
Just to follow up, the caller made some good points there about steps in the regulatory process that were present before the current Sweetheart Bill was written for them. In Tiffany's name, of course, but written by the company.
And Tiffany, let's clarify.
Senator Tom Tiffany from Hazelhurst, Wisconsin, right?
And he's the one who has been fronting for the mine company, so to speak.
And then information, like has been coming out about the sulfide and asbestos, could have been presented as part of evaluating an environmental impact statement or at a master hearing. Neither one of those things will take place with the current mining bill for the DNR, those steps that would have been there in the past.
Yeah, and we got here a message that I would like to share with our listeners, and I will want to hear from you, Mike, about the harvest camp. But before we do that, the message is that donations for the harvest camp are being collected at Victory Cafe, which is 2710 Atwood Avenue, until tomorrow morning. Some of the things that they need are winter camping supplies, such as propane tanks, thermal underwear, socks, etc., and can also make checks out to AGLP when you go there to Victory Cafe. Tell us, Mike, about the harvest camp. What is it? How is it going?
The Harvest and Education Project camp that is up in Pinokies is a wonderful place. It's a wonderful experience to be around. There's a small core of folks that are actually living there, and they're going to winter camp all winter. Along the way, they're harvesting and they're putting up food and they're educating and hiking and helping people get to know that unbelievably beautiful area up there in Pinoki Hills. They are in need of donations and help, as you can imagine. Wood, as an example, and firewood and such, they're in the elements 24/7. So wood is a necessity, and people have been very generous. They've had thousands of people come through, and there's lots of folks that help out, but at the same time, they still have needs. All the harvesting and all of the activities that they do there are rooted in treaty rights, the exercise of treaty rights, and it's one of those things that is a legal question that kind of gets called up when you look at most recently the mining law that restricted access to public access to some of the Pinoki areas that where GTAC wants to mine. There's still a legal question as to whether or not that would apply to a tribal member with treaty rights. And of course, most of the tribal leaders that I know understand that by law, the state of Wisconsin cannot legislate away treaty rights. So as a result, you get things like I'm debating whether or not I might go up there to do a little deer hunting this weekend,
mm-hmm.
Up in the area that's supposedly closed, because by exercise of my treaty rights there hunting, I don't believe there's anybody that could tell me that I couldn't access those publicly accessible managed forest croplands. So, and if they did, I would say, well, why did the DNR or why did the legislators carve out a 9-day deer season for non-tribal people? The reason they did that is because they obviously knew it would impact hunting rights. And as a tribal member, my hunting rights kind of extend out well out beyond a 9-day season. So, yeah. So the harvest camp is there, kind of, as an exercise of those treaty rights that's in a state of perpetuity.
Yeah. Well, our guests again are Mike Wiggins, who you just heard, the tribal chair of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, and in the studio with me here is Jason Huberty, who's a geologist. Again, the donations for the harvest camp can be are collected until tomorrow morning at Victory Cafe, 2710 Atwood Avenue. They need all kinds of winter supplies, and I'm sure they would be happy to get the checks to Omania. And let's get to our next caller. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
From a practical point of view, iron prices are low at the moment, and taconite is a low, by definition, this is from Webster, it's a low-grade iron ore that's pelletized on site and then is delivered to blast furnaces. Well, we hardly have any blast furnaces for iron or, you know, pelletized or not anymore in this country. We've sent all these operations to other countries. So where would this iron end up? And the pelletizing on site, you know, is a tremendously noisy operation. I don't know whether it would go on 24 hours a day or not. Second, in Wisconsin, most of the mines that are proposed are right next to major bodies of water, either, you know, Lake Superior, for heaven's sake, but then rivers, too. Is that because they figure these bodies of water are convenient dumping places? And third, and really my question is, could you please describe the Klein Group of Florida? My understanding is that it is a huge coal mining conglomerate with a bad record, and I'd kind of like to know something about how it relates to Gobekli Taconite, which I think is just a, you know, that's just a created offspring, so that accountability will be less to the original company.
And what was the name of the group that you're asking about?
The Klein Group.
Oh, the Klein Group,
it's
yeah.
It's the Florida coal mining group.
Yeah.
It's the real, they're doing the mining, but they don't have experience in iron mining.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for these questions. Jason, did you want to start?
Sure, I can take those. I see. So for the first one, she's accurate that taconite is a type of low-grade iron ore that's different than the shaft iron mining that occurred 100 years ago, where the concentrations of iron were upwards of 60 or 70% in those shaft mines. In the taconite mines, they're mining rock that is at maximum 40% iron. And that's a good quality taconite ore, like the kind that's been mined in Michigan and Minnesota, whereas the kind in the Pinokies is at the very lowest end and has somewhere generously 20 to 25% iron, which means 75% of the rock is not the ore that they're after.
So what's the sense in even mining for that?
It's why it hasn't been mined for over 70 years, and the even slightly higher concentrations in the neighboring states have been targeted, while here companies have come and left. So she's right, there isn't an infrastructure in place, and the company hasn't done a very good job in explaining where these activities are going to occur. I don't really have a comment for her second question, but the third one for the Klein Group of Florida, what I know is that they acquired the property from RGGS Minerals as part of a larger deal where they got different properties in different mines, and for whatever reason they started this company called GTAC. It's kind of hard for me to call them a company because they've got 5 employees. They really don't have the expertise there to do the kind of work that they're talking about doing when they devalue the work that I and others have done going up to scout the area just to say what is here. And then the company says, well, we're going to deny what you've seen and we're going to say this isn't the proper process to do it. They haven't suggested an alternative process, which just shows how the lack of seriousness that they've taken this.
So you say that GTAC has 5 employees?
To my knowledge, 5 employees, 3 with scientific background. are they going to be doing all the independent testing of the labs? They've drilled 8 cores this year, whereas in the 1950s, U.S. Steel drilled 250 cores. GTAC has refused to let the public look at those old cores that are in storage in private warehouses in Minnesota. If U.S. Steel drilled 250 and they didn't see a reason to mine the area, what's GTAC going to learn with 8 cores? And then they've reduced their bulk sampling sites from 5 to 3. We're really giving the DNR the bare minimum, even less than that, of information to make a decision.
So GTAC is not an established mining company?
They're brand new as of 3 years ago, as far as I know.
Okay. Mike?
Yes.
What do you have to say to all of these questions? I just learned that GTAC is kind of a fiction. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, well, you know, GTAC is, again, is kind of held by the Klein Group, and the Klein Group, as you go up the chain of command, you find a coal mining billionaire at the top, Chris Klein. The Klein Group and Chris Klein's, you know, billionaire fortune was made in large part in the Appalachian Mountains, and what our friend from that area, soldier Bob Kincaid, calls the human sacrifice zone, of the Appalachians there. That's where they made their fortune, and it was made essentially liquefying the actual earth and state there. They also have coal mining operations in Illinois, the Klein Group. All of that has been very problematic, in terms of impacts to humans, impacts to the environment, and impacts to water. GTAC, yeah, is a recent manifestation. People who have been following closely will remember the first president that came around was Matt Fifield. Matt Fifield is the one who told the Northlanders up here at a public meeting, we will operate this mine and permit this mine under the current mining law that exists in Wisconsin, which turned out to be the first huge lie to the public up here, because as he was speaking, GTAC's lawyers were busy writing the current mining law that, you know, has essentially deregulated a lot of the environmental protections that used to be here in Wisconsin. Fifield flew the coop. Theories abound on why and where he went. I know that he chose a residence on Madeline Island, maybe the Big Lake, and traveling the ferry every day kind of got into his psyche. Who knows? But he's no longer around. Who we have as a president now, again, is Bill Williams, who is fresh out of Spain and probably running from extradition activities for his crimes against the environment there. You know, all of that comes together to really show a pattern of deception and the reality that GTAC just doesn't have it in terms of competency to really even negotiate their very own relaxed mining law, let alone explode a mountainside that is going to have everything draining into Lake Superior.
Mm-hmm. And we have one more caller. Let's get to that person quickly. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for having this program, Esty. This is Thistle, and I do some work with Madison Action for Mining Alternatives, or MAMA, and it's really great to hear this being discussed. And my question is, I think primarily for Mike Wiggins, and that is, I mean, I was just listening to what you were saying, and it sounds like if they're incompetent, maybe they're not going to explode the mountain and it's going to all drain into Lake Superior. But a lot of incompetent people, it seems like, or a small minority that has a lot of concentrated power, are making plans and getting sanctioned by Wisconsin's laws to do this type of destructive endeavor. And my question is if they actually do start doing the more destructive bulk sampling and then finally the explosions and creating this huge mine, what can we as citizens in Wisconsin do to stop it? And what can you comment on nonviolent civil disobedience and the role of nonviolent civil disobedience in this struggle, if push finally comes to shove and these huge destructive forces take hold, even though it's this small and competent group, somehow it seems like a real threat. And so I'd like to hear you talk about what kind of organizing you'd like to see citizens groups like MAMA doing in Wisconsin to prepare for, because the people I talk to, they're willing to die to stop this mine. And so I hope that we can have an outward discussion. If push comes to shove, what is it that we can do so that they actually cannot blow up the mountain? And thank you so much.
Okay, and actually let me widen it to asking you what would you like people to do right now, and maybe we never have to do any kind of more extreme thing when the mountaintop is blown. How about stopping it before it happens? Mike.
Well, that's, you know, it's a very, very difficult topic to kind of think about, first of all, let alone comment on. The reality of what could come to pass in terms of the Pinoki Hills being destroyed is real, and the reality of wanting to prevent that is you know a driving kind of motivation as for me as a tribal leader, but also for most of the folks I know that call this place home. This place being our tribe, Ashland County, even Iron County, these places that are downwind and downstream from the toxicity. Talking, I guess, off the cuff, and in quick response to some of the things that were asked of me is something that's very difficult to do because of the reality of the fact that what the caller said there, that folks feel so passionately about this issue that they'd be willing to sacrifice themselves, that is nothing that to take lightly. And so as far as I guess you'd say peaceful civil disobedience, as far as you know, those types of activities, all I can say is this, is that the Bad River Tribe has been committed and dedicated to peaceful protest and peaceful opposition from the very get-go. From the moment I first met with Matt Fifield and a mining company in a blind meeting where they just dropped into my office, I understood that this was going to have to be very peaceful with respect to all of the passion that tribal members I know carry for our home here, carry for our history, our ancestors, and all of those future generations that are gonna call this place home forever. Our vision transcends, you know, the most glorious economic dreams of Bill Williams and his mining cronies, you know, in their 15 to 20 year free-for-all profit that they hope for. Our vision at the tribe here transcends hundreds of years of fishing, of putting our hands in the water and sending our kids to play on the riverbed.